Welcome to This Is Money Show. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert and development editor Rich Browning. On the agenda, Europe is okay, but should we be looking further afield when it comes to investing? And can we avoid another financial crisis? Not according to one professor of economics. Not without war or massive climate change. But first, vive la France, vive la République, vive l'Europe. With the French election out of the way and the safe choice of Emmanuel Macron elected, is it time to invest in Europe? On the latest investing show, Simon has been speaking to Sigma Investment Management's Tom Beckett and asked, are Europe's problems over?
If you look at markets, markets would tell you that they are. I have a much more sceptical view of Europe. The election of Monsieur Macron perhaps is more dangerous than people actually probably realise. I think that there is a chance people like Mr Juncker, people like Frau Merkel and indeed Monsieur Macron himself see what's happened in France as the green light for go for the reignition of the European project. I think that if you saw in the first round of the French election voting and indeed with examples like our decision to leave the European Union, Euroscepticism is rising across Europe and in particular in places like Italy, which I think will be the next flashpoint within Europe. So I think the concern for Europe is that actually they believe there is no problems and problems are being solved. But I think the three things which created issues and led to Madame Le Pen doing better than many people suspected in the first place, migration, terrorism and a moribund economy in many places in Europe, are probably here to stay. And I think that really sets the scene for a French election in 5 years' time, where I think that one of the Le Pens has a decent chance of winning that election. I think that Europe is in danger of forgetting quite how grave the problems in the region are. I think that is the biggest risk. I think there is an enormous amount of complacency, whether in terms of political attitudes or indeed in financial markets and asset prices. So let's just think about where the complacency comes. I think in the UK, I think there's a certain amount of complacency towards our own political situation. I would expect the Conservatives to win a sizable majority, but nowhere near the size of the majority that's been talked about in some of the press. And I think really that's when the hard work has to start, because let's be honest about this, the European politicians are stupid enough to cut off their own noses to spite their face with regards to our Brexit negotiations. And now, I think there's a lot of complacency towards the belief that the exit from the Eurozone is going to be anything other than messy. I personally think that the negotiations are going to be very protracted and perhaps pointless in the end.
OK, so bearing all that in mind, is it time to invest in Europe, Simon? That was what you wanted to know on the investing show. What did you find out?
Well, when we discussed it with Tom, he said that he thought that short term, yes, there was definitely money to be made from Europe, but that people needed to be a bit cautious. They either needed to pick very carefully where they were investing. So don't just invest in Europe because you think, OK, Europe's fixed, basically. Because what he was saying is Europe is not fixed. So don't expect this kind of...
Does anyone think that? That just because Emmanuel Macron is in, this guy with no experience, is that right?
Yeah, but this was seen as a major, major, major stumbling block for Europe. It was seen as basically French election goes the wrong way, Marine Le Pen gets elected, France goes out of the euro, France has its own EU referendum, the whole world is in a ton of trouble. France is in now, Macron's, you know, the man, the continuity man, he's big into the European project. Obviously, we've got German elections, we've got Italian elections, you know, still to come. But this French one was seen as the big test. And I think there is also the other element where the European economies are recovering. You know, Europe has looked pretty awful for quite a long time economically, and things are improving. They've managed to get a little bit of a pickup in inflation. Germany, you know, companies in Germany are storming ahead. The German DAX has been hitting new record levels. Mm-hmm. And you could be forgiven for thinking, okay, this is a great contrarian opportunity because everybody has hated Europe. I'm going to buy in. I'm going to try and make some money. And there's quite a bit of rhetoric around that. The point Tom made was, yes, it gets labelled a contrarian opportunity, but there's so many people labelling a contrarian opportunity. Can you still call it a contrarian opportunity? Or has that boat actually sailed? You know, did that mm-hmm. boat sail 6 months, a year ago? And also, he's talked about the essentially what you have to think of as the opportunity cost. Say you've got £1,000 to invest. Now, you could invest it in Europe, and you could do quite well. But you need to be thinking over a horizon of maybe 5 years at least when you're investing money. So, yeah, you could do well over the next 5 years. Or have Europe's problems not been fixed to the extent that actually at some point within those 5 years they're going to roll back around again? Probably highly likely that that is actually the case, unless they do something to seriously look at why there is all this dissatisfaction with the political elite and with what's going on across the whole of Europe. Mm-hmm. And I would include the UK within that, to be perfectly honest. I think we all need to look at why so many people are so angry.
It's going to take longer than 5 years. Yeah. That's taken decades.
Yeah. Or do you take your £1,000 and invest it in a part of the world where, yeah, there's other problems, and certainly they don't have the perfect political systems, and they might have a lot more authoritarian political systems, but what they do have is an element of growth, be that driven by demographics, be that driven by the emergence of a middle class, be that driven by just the fact that they have lots more companies that when you look at them on a global scale are much smaller and so have a much greater room to grow than if you look at companies in the UK, in Europe and in the US, which the big companies there are very, very big. They are the world's biggest companies. And how much bigger can they actually grow? So what he's saying is, you know, would you be better off putting that money into somewhere like the emerging markets, for example? And he talked in particular about India.
He just got back from there,
yeah,
hasn't he?
Yeah, he'd been to India. He also talked, and you know, the Indian stock market's been doing very well. It's quite expensive, but he believes that the opportunities that lie there are better than the opportunities that lie in Europe. Or Vietnam as well is one he mentioned. Now, Vietnam, fairly risky, but over 5 years, do you think Vietnam has better opportunities for companies there to grow, to make a profit, to profit from demographic change, to profit from the emerging middle class, than the old world where everyone is probably going to spend the next years, 5 years arguing about stuff?
Rich, I'm going to bring you in. To make up for my lack of French knowledge, you have it in abundance because I believe you spend a lot of time there. You've got a French wife. Am I right?
My wife's French. I met her in France when I worked there.
All right, so that makes you an expert, in my view, on France.
It was
if
quite
that's
a long
right.
time ago, and it has changed significantly. It's still a very difficult place to do business. So maybe this guy, who
Macron, yeah,
the investment banker, maybe he can turn this around and make it an exciting place to create business in the first place that the people want to invest in.
What is this sentiment like in France? How much has, I guess, Le Pen got under the skin of the French psyche? I understand in the city it's very business, but what about outside? How much of a problem is that going to be for France, for the rest of Europe and investing and Brexit negotiations?
I think if the economy picks up enough, then it largely becomes irrelevant. I sense that the whole Le Pen thing was slightly overstated, given the number of people that went last Sunday, was it, and just rubbished their ballot papers. That was actually more than voted for the Le Pen. So,
but either way, that in itself shows a certain amount of dissatisfaction with the current system.
There's a massive amount of dissatisfaction, but there is here as well. And, you know, like Simon says, we probably ought to spend some time trying to understand why. Because I don't. I really don't. I mean, there's just this palpable anger about something that nobody's able to put their finger on. Is it really just immigration? If it's that simple, then I don't think it is, though. I really don't. There's massive amounts of debt, household debt, that everybody's got themselves into is a problem. I think people are generally worried about that and look for excuses. But you have a improving economy, and that becomes less of a problem, so you calm down a bit, I think.
How much of this, Simon, on that thought, thank you, Rich, it's about the economy, stupid. Are people more dissatisfied, perhaps, as a result of the financial crash, for example? You've got perspective. You've been working in this industry a long time. What are your thoughts?
Yes, they are, but I think that one of the problems is that they believe that they're not getting a fair share of the spoils. There is an anger that translates across various countries that it's all right for the I'm All Right Jack Brigade, the whatever you want to call them in whatever country you're in, the liberal elite or whatever they are, who are coining it in and are doing very nicely at the moment. But it's not so great for the other people, the people who in this country we'd characterise as being on the 0 hours contracts and things like that.
But why have a go at the EU? Why have a go at Europe?
Well, I mean, you tend to choose something that you're angry against and you choose something that you want to scapegoat.
The man, the system.
But also, there's this question of what's the EU ever done for us? What have the Romans ever done for us, eh? But there is this scenario where people see it as an example of a detached political system that is there essentially to serve itself, you know? And if you look at a lot of the things that have gone on since Brexit, particularly, I would say, this bit where Theresa May and the government said that they tried to sort out what was going to happen to foreign nationals, foreign EU nationals living in the UK and UK citizens living overseas, and that they genuinely wanted to sort it before Christmas, and the EU told them to get essentially get stuff, that would be in the negotiations. Now, I have no reason to believe that that isn't true. And I think that that is symptomatic of the kind of EU attitude to this thing and symptomatic of the, why people voted against it. Look at what happened the other week after that dinner where there are all those leaks. Mm. Britain's living in cloud cuckoo land. This whole rhetoric of punishment. And I think that actually, I think that our government would be quite happy to try and push the rhetoric towards a let's try and do something that's good for everyone. Good for us, good for you. Let's work together. And I think the rhetoric that is driving the we can't do that is coming from the EU. And I think that that comes from an organisation that is perceived to be self-serving and mainly concerned with its own processes and its own rules and its own people and, you know, keeping itself in business. And, you know, I don't know enough about the EU. I've never spent time working within the EU organisation to know whether that's true. But I think a lot of people see that. And so a lot of people get angry at it in the same way that they get angry at the financial system or the banks, because they see that as the same thing, a part of society that is there to reward itself and serve itself, and the rest of the world can go hang. So I'm not surprised that you have people getting angry about those things and putting those two things together. But I do think that one of the things that there is a problem with is inequality and our failure to tackle inequality properly. And inequality has got less in this country if you actually look at the official figures, but the perception of inequality has not got less. And I don't know what we do about it, but I think we probably need to spend some of the next 5 years thinking about it in order to do something about all those angry people.
Agree, Rich?
Mostly, yes.
Which part do you not agree with? Your editor who pays your wages.
I think we're describing negotiations that probably should have taken place before the referendum, and that it's all very well saying that Europe's this closed shop, self-serving, but yeah, that's exactly what it is. If we're not part of it, why are they going to talk to us even? It kind of seems fair enough. I know I shouldn't say that, but
We know important people listen to this show, Rich.
We're going to find it extremely difficult to negotiate whatever it is we're after.
On that gloomy note, I thought we'd end with something a little lighter. No, I'm not. We're going to discuss the inevitability of another financial crisis. Band down the hatches, folks, because it is coming. Apparently, boom and bust is inbuilt to the capitalist system in which we live. So after a period of relative calm, you know what's coming up next. Your personal finance expert, Rachel Rickard-Strauss, has been talking to Steve Keane, Professor of Economics at Kingston University, who's just written a book about this.
The strengths of capitalism lead to crises, not the weaknesses, not the mistakes, but the actual strengths of capitalism. And one of the strengths, of course, is people are encouraged to innovate. So it's certainly a positive when you compare it to Soviet systems and the feudal systems beforehand. But to finance that innovation, you end up borrowing money. And what tends to happen, and I've done the modelling of this as well and using modern modelling tools, the tendency is to borrow more during a boom to finance investment, less during a slump, of course. But when you borrow during a boom, you're expecting the boom conditions to continue forever. They don't. So your capacity to repay the money you borrow declines. You have less capacity to repay the debt than you thought you'd have. And this is talking at a collective level as well. So you go from a boom, increasing finance using debt, you pay it down a bit, the next boom starts again, and you ratchet up through debt levels until finally you take on, during a particular boom, such a level of debt that when the crisis comes, you simply can't repay the debt and there's a global crash.
Cheery, cheery. Simon, I'm clearly not a professor of economics, but who was it who said the definition of madness is doing something over and over again and thinking you're going to get a different result? Wasn't that Einstein? Now, he was a smart man. If we know that this is going on, boom, bust, boom, why don't we do something to change it?
What, you mean get rid of it like Gordon Brown did?
Yeah, exactly. Gordon Brown had it right. Did he put it in stone, though? That's where he went
maybe
wrong.
Maybe it's just a natural way of things. There's this idea of creative destruction and you need to have boom and bust to have creative destruction, but what you need to do is you need to be brave enough to allow the bust to have creative destruction, where basically things go up, things go really well, people get euphoric. That's just human nature, And then when things go bad, you need to allow... It's like with the forest fires and, you know, raising it and then it grows back up again. That's the idea of creative
but
destruction.
But is there anything natural about a system that we've built?
No, there isn't. No, okay. but we keep distorting it, I think, as well. In that the problem is that our response to the financial crisis was to throw a lot more money at the problem and create a lot more money. And I think that one of the reasons why this video that Rachel did this week, the interview with Steve Keen, really chimed with our readers is because there's a lot of our readers who actually think that it is not a case of if there is another financial crisis, but when there is another financial crisis. And there are also a lot of our readers, and this is reflected in the comments, who think that that next financial crisis is probably going to come up reasonably soon in the grand scheme of things and is going to be considerably worse than the last one, which, let us remember, was described as the worst financial crisis since the 1920s depression. So,
and let's look at the situation. We're not exactly in the clear blue waters now, are we? We're still suffering a massive hangover from that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're still struggling with growth. We're still struggling with various problems. And also we've got a scenario where... people have even more debt and countries have even more debt. And a lot of the debt that was taken on by the banks has now been taken on by shoveled across and has now been taken on by nation states. So people think it's a question of when, not if. And I must admit, I find it quite difficult to disagree with that point of view.
Rich, nodding along there.
I love this video. I think it's urge anybody to watch it. He's a sort of contrarian economics professor that I... it's one of my go-tos. But can I... spoiler alert this, reveal his solutions to all this. I mean, basically the debt problem that I mentioned to you before. I'm just updating my sort of money saving tips that I try and do every year. And the household debt in this country is terrifying. Just the sort of average credit card balance, if you were to pay that off at a minimum payment, it would take about 25 years. And that's the average. I mean, most people have got loads more than this, about £2,500 or something. But so he, in this interview, takes this to the global level and explains that, yeah, we're inevitably walking into this financial storm, the like of which we haven't seen before, possibly worse than the Great Depression. But he has a solution, three solutions. What saved us from the Great Depression was World War II.
Oh, great. So let's have a war. Okay.
So it was a solution because there's so much investment into the war effort,
yes,
that the money starts to get distributed but around the economy and everything's okay again, and that fueled the bust in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And then there's this constant cycle of boom and bust. Interestingly, he said we probably aren't going to have a third world war, which is good news.
Okay, great. So we'll have a war, but it won't be the war to end all wars. Great. That will be a problem for growth.
What's going to save us this time is the climate change. Not immediately, but he says that it will become such an important issue that governments around the world are just going to have to invest to save civilization as we know it. But that is kind of inevitable. And in the short time, there'll be some pretty bad stuff. Sleep tight.
Simon, can we resurrect the show from that?
We can. I'm going to finish on a more positive note.
Okay. Cool.
This morning I sat down, I had a late breakfast, and I read Tom Utley's column in the Daily Mail, which is something I always like to do. Some people might think that his columns are a bit old-fashioned, but actually they're very well written, they're very entertaining. And this week he talked about a question that was asked of Julian Fellowes, the author and playwright. Which would he rather have? One of four things: to have been born with beauty, brains, money, or birth, so i.e. to be part of the aristocracy. And he had a discussion about this. And at the end of his column, he says, if I had to choose one of the above, therefore, birth it would be. He said, you know, I'd go for that one. But isn't the correct answer none of the above? For what are beauty, brains, money, or birth beside the greatest gifts life can bestow? Good health, loving parents, a happy family, and the company of true friends. And whether there is another financial crisis or all these other things that we've talked about and we've worried about in this, if you've got good health, you've had loving parents, you've got a happy family, and you've got good friends, that's all you need.
And we are indeed, all of us here, wealthy indeed on that score. Editor Simon Lambert and development editor Rich Browning.